midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, the long campaign is just about over. Just a month from tomorrow, on September 12th, Minnesota Democrats will decide which DFL candidate for the U.S. Senate will move on to the November general election against Republican incumbent Rod Grams. If you're one of the people who hasn't decided yet who you're going to vote for, or if you're one of those folks for whom there is there's no way you're going to vote for a Democrat, but simply want to scout out the opposition, well, we think today's midday may be just what the doctor ordered. Today we have been joined here in the studio by the four major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate. We'll be discussing some of the major issues of the campaign. A little later you'll have a chance to call in with your questions. And also, if you have a computer and want to watch today's discussion, we are webcasting this program on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. Great opportunity to learn a little bit more about the candidates. So let me introduce them. I'll be asking one of them to comment on an issue. The others can add their comments if they wish. Then we'll move on to another issue for the next candidate, a third issue for the third candidate, so on and so forth. That's kind of the format here. In alphabetical order, Minneapolis trial attorney Michael Cerisi, former state auditor Mark Dayton, state senator Jerry Janicich, and Twin Cities business executive Rebecca Yanish. Folks, thanks for coming in today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Gary. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, let's get started here. Michael Cerisi, let me start with you, a political question, if you will. What with the Democratic National Convention getting underway next week, apparently, if what you hear can be believed, a number of people who would normally be voting for the Democrat for president plan to vote for Ralph Nader. What would you say to them?
I would say to vote for the Democratic candidate, Al Gore. Al Gore will win, and Al Gore has tremendous experience in government. He's an outstanding individual. I know him personally. He will make a great president. And when you compare his background experience across a long career as against George W. Bush, I think that the question before the electorate is very clear. Al Gore will be an outstanding president.
No Tweedledum, Tweedledee?
No.
very little.
Mark Dayton?
Yes. I agree with Mike. I mean, one of two people are going to be president of the United States come next January, George Bush or Al Gore, and there are profound differences on the whole spectrum of the very issues that we disagree with Rod Grams about. So I think if people want their vote to count, and most do, it's imperative that they vote for Al Gore, or we're going to be stuck with another Republican administration.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Yanish?
Yes, and I really think the Gore-Lieberman team is a very strong team, and I congratulate Gore on his selection there. I mean, he's really picked a partner that has the experience and provides a new perspective and a new choice for our United States citizens. I think that's a real compliment to our party and the inclusiveness of our party.
Jerry Janicich?
Yep, I believe the Lieberman pick was outstanding. And I like Al Gore. I think that if you take a look at him over the last 8 years as vice president, he's been a perfect role model. He's worked hard. He cares about all DFL issues. I think he's going to do very well. And I would ask whoever that was to rethink where they're headed and tell them to take a good hard look at the vice president.
Mark Dayton?
I just add, and I don't fault the vice president or Senator Lieberman, but as a Democrat, I'm appalled, and I'm not going next week because the top ticket for all the perks and a reserve seat at the Republican National Convention was $250,000 a person. The Democratic Convention next week is $350,000 a person. And in the midst of all that glitz that people will watch next week, as they did last week at the Republican National Convention, I hope people ask themselves, who's paying for these shows and everything going on? We've all been talking about campaign finance reform, which Rod Grams has steadfastly opposed, and I think this is exactly why we need it.
Michael Cerisi?
I'd follow up on that a little bit more. I mean, keep in mind that only about 8.8%, I think, was the rating that watched the Republican convention, and hopefully the Democratic convention will at least exceed that. But I think that speaks to the fact that the American electorate, they understand what's going on, and they don't like what's going on in terms of campaign finance, and they want to change. And what we need in the United States Senate are people who have affected change in the past, who can make a difference. And I think that's what people are going to vote for come this fall.
Mm-hmm. When Jerry Genesich?
Well, I think Mark kind of brings up a pretty interesting point on the whole idea of campaign finance and money in politics, just in general. I'm going to go to L.A. We're not sure where we're staying or what we're doing, but we're going to go. It's part of being a Democrat, I believe, and it's part of what we believe in, and that is going to be, since I was a kid, I've dreamt about going to one of those conventions, and now as the endorsed candidate, I wouldn't miss it, and I'm going to go out there, I'm going to shake some hands. Who knows, maybe somebody will give me a $20 bill while I'm out there, and I'll be able to keep up with everybody. You know, but I'm going to go.
Sorry,
I think it has a value.
Mark Day Knight, I'm going to spend a week in Minnesota myself, but I don't worry about you ending up in a $350,000. See, you're not the Democrat. You're not the Democrat I'm worried about out there.
Yeah. No, Mark, bad chance of that. That's true.
But I think overall, the message here is that our convention will be a convention of inclusiveness. You know, certainly there'll be the high price tickets, but I am confident that our delegates from Minnesota that they're there are going to present a diversity that was not there in Philadelphia, and we'll present a discussion that's more than just talking the talk. We walk the walk, and that's an important message that has to come out of Los Angeles.
Michael Cerisi.
Well, the Republicans presented a diversity, but it was only in myth, not in reality, and I think that's what Rebecca is alluding to. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party, for a long, long time, has taken up the issues of those who have been left behind, and today, in an ever-widening income and wealth gap in this country, we need substance, not show. And I think that's what's going to be important in the Democratic Convention. But the fact is, money plays too predominant a role in elective politics. And, well, Jerry, you agree, but you have your constituencies, too, and that's why you're going to Los Angeles, because you're going to be dealing with the unions and others that have supported you. And, you know, that's why you're going.
Yep.
But I think we have to get beyond that and get to what are the real issues of campaign finance reform. It's not that Congress men and women sell their vote. It's a question of who they have access to. If you have an issue coming up before you in Congress, you only have so many hours in the day. And if 40 people want to get in touch with you, 39 of which are people who contributed to your campaign, a congressperson is most likely to listen to those before they listen to the rest of the people out there. So your viewpoint gets tainted. It is not exposed to the full range of experiences in society. And that's why we need campaign finance reform.
Do we, let's move on to question number two then. Mark Dayton, do we need total public financing of campaigns in this country?
Well, I'd go a long way toward that. I think the Minnesota model is an excellent one where we have partial public financing. I would stop short of total myself because I think you need some kind of qualifying measure. But certainly the kind of system we have in Minnesota where we have limits on contributions, voluntary limits on expenditures based on receiving a good amount of public financing, and then once you get to the general election, then the candidates, as they are for president now, are totally and should be totally publicly financed, and we should have reduced media rates and the like. I mean, people rightfully decry the cost of these elections. I did an analysis. Three-fourths of my budget will be buying media time. So I'd be delighted if they would like to reduce the cost of elections by discounting that dramatically, which
would be good for me, Mark.
Well, since they're FCC licenses, they should be at a very reduced rate.
Rebecca,
up to a certain amount.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. You know, to me, there should be a balance there, you know, with the public and private getting involved. But the struggle I have is when we look, and we've all talked about the issues here, of health care for children, of prescription medication for our seniors. And when you look at the needs in terms of our federal dollars, you know, 100% public funding, to me, takes away from so many things we need to be investing in for the people in this nation. So I can't see 100%, but I agree there has to be limits on what's spent, and there has to be some free media time or some way of being able to accommodate that.
Mike Cerisi?
I would disagree with that, and I think that at the last debate we had, Jerry and I were the ones that said there should be full funding at the federal level. And the reason I disagree with what Rebecca said is that there is enough revenue to have full federal funding and still devote the necessary resources to the issues that Rebecca just mentioned, prescription drugs for seniors, education, health care, revitalizing rural America and paying down the debt. We can do these things. I mean, my goodness, if you take a look at the defense budget, we could save about $20 billion over the next year just by reducing the intercontinental ballistic missiles down to SALT II levels. We have, 500 Minuteman missiles with three independently targeted warheads on each missile. We have 50 Peacekeeper missiles. There's a great name, Peacekeeper missiles, ICBMs, and 18 Trident missiles. The OMB has done a study, and they said you could reduce these missiles down to SALT II levels and save $20 billion over 10 years. That would fund a lot of campaigns. And still we'd have money for the other issues. What's necessary is to make sure that all viewpoints are being listened to, not just heard, but listened to. And that will start changing, I think, the direction of federal funding in this country.
Jerry Janicich?
Yeah, I've said right along that we have to do something. I mean, politics is supposed to be about people and shouldn't be about money. And you should be going out talking to people. You should be touching people. I, for one, who knows it probably better than anybody throughout this campaign, I can't compete money-wise. I mean, I just can't, and most Minnesotans couldn't. And I think that if it was a publicly financed campaign, you take it to the people. And politics is about people, and I really believe that we as a nation have to go out further to allow that to happen. And there's we don't have to spend all the money. You put a limit on how much you can spend, and you put a limit on how much you raise. Although I'm convinced that shouldn't be part of it anymore. I mean, I sit by a phone for 3, 4, 5 hours a day, like I'm sure probably everybody does here, and calling people you don't even know for money. And in my case, when you've been representing working men and women for the last 12 years in the legislature and 6 years on the county board, we have 3 weeks till school starts. And every one of the people I know is going to spend $250 to $300 for school clothes. How do I ask them for $25 or $50 or $75 or $100 to finance a political campaign? Doesn't make sense. Makes no sense at all.
Mark Dayton?
I don't think we're far apart on this. I would just make the point, again, going back to the Minnesota model, if you have, as I understand, full public financing of all candidates and campaigns to be, we have four other candidates for the DFL in the primary who are not here today, who I would predict if we had full financing the day you paid your filing fee, we'd have 80, and you'd have to have this much bigger studio, Gary.
So which wouldn't be bad.
Which is, well, to a point, but I think that what the Minnesota system does is it and you know it better, Jerry, because you run in it. I ran for auditor in it, and I ran for governor in it. You qualify by getting a lot of small contributions. You have to go out there and build the support. You do touch people because you're touching people at the grassroots level. I think there's a way to incorporate that initiative into the system and then still accomplish taking this big money and the hours that not only
me
as challengers but incumbents. I mean, if the people of America could count up the hours that everybody doing this was spending, as you said, dialing for dollars rather than talking, listening to people. And I'm not going to accuse anybody individually of buying a vote, but I think it's close enough that I would say that in general terms. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has one lobbyist for every two members of Congress. Why do you think our government is not covering our seniors and all of our citizens on this outrageous gouging of their pocketbooks by the pharmaceutical industry when the Canadian government is doing it quite effectively? And my bus is going up there. Seniors can get, we've averaged the savings of $350 a senior. So there is a direct payoff. These people are not making charitable contributions. They want results.
Mark, mm-hmm. I'd like to have a bus.
When you look at that number, it's just not the number of lobbyists, Mark. It's the $9 million they spent on lobbying and contributions also. And you hear so much of the protection of the margins for the pharmaceutical companies. Well, my goodness, they talk about investing in research development. Well, there's $9 million that's been diverted away from that so they can protect those high profit margins and continue the price gouging. It's got to stop.
That was Rebecca Yanish, Mike Cerisi.
Well, if we want to talk about prescription drugs, I think the issue is much more complex than just talking about $9 million. I've happened to take on drug companies during the course of my career and set national standards in beating them back and getting defective products off the market, particularly in the case of women's health. And there are a number of things we can do there. We have had a high-price, high-profit policy toward prescription drugs in this country. Other countries don't have that. in terms of internal pricing within a corporation, they know how to use the tax laws and pricings across the world because they're multinational corporations, and they know how to price that and make Americans pay a undue burden with regard to research and development. So we need to start taking a look at that, and congressional hearings will help in that regard. Keep in mind that when the price of gasoline spiked up, they announced that there was going to be an FTC examination of that, and the next day there was a precipitous drop in gasoline prices. We need to take a look at how that is being done. I know how that's being done, and I know you can change the conduct of those companies and make them use the tax laws more to Americans' advantage rather than to foreign citizens' advantage. We're subsidizing research and development for other countries. Two-thirds of the drugs are developed here in the United States, and there's a whole host of other things we can do to bring down prescription drugs. First of all, extend Medicare to prescription drugs. That gives tremendous leverage to the government in negotiating. That doesn't mean the government's going to tell people what drugs they're going to use. It simply means you get leverage at the bargaining table. And the proof of that is the Veterans Administration now and how it's able to purchase drugs and the cost to our vets when they go into VA hospitals, which is substantially less than the public at large. And there's a number of other things that I think we need to do in that area.
Jerry Janison.
Well, I mean, everybody here agrees that we need to take on that issue, and I think it's so simple, and all you do is broaden Medicare. You do have the delivery systems there. You can do almost anything through that system without shipping the drugs out, exporting the drugs to other countries so our people can buy them back cheaper. That's the doggonest thing I've ever heard in my life, and I think that that's part of political will, and all you need to do, part of the problem is they don't want it to be part of Medicare out there. And if it becomes part of Medicare, the problem goes away.
Hey, Jerry's exactly right. That's why the drug companies are lobbying so hard against extending Medicare to prescription drugs. They know it levels the playing field
sure.
of negotiation.
We can set rates. We can do all those kinds of things.
Mark Dayton.
The emphasis has been on seniors, and rightfully so, because Medicare does not cover prescription medicines. But they're working families and families with kids who need prescription medicines. I mean, this is society-wide, and our government, again, is doing virtually nothing on a comprehensive way to prevent that kind of gouging. And like you made the point of the Veterans Administration, the HMOs, the large corporations that self-insure negotiate 25% to 40% reductions in the prices. It's there to be taken away from this profiteering, and we just have had a government that's been captive of the industries, the insurance and the pharmaceutical and the people who are making big profits off of other people's disease, illness, and misery. And it's, as one woman said in St. Cloud, she said, it's sinful. You know, it's full of sin what's going on, and it's sinful that we have a Congress out there that does nothing about this, and that's why we need to replace people like Rod Grimm's.
Rebecca Yanish.
And it's the stories I hear, too, when I'm out in visiting in the communities and hosting roundtables to talk about issues. The issues that come up immediately are prescription medication, our senior citizens cutting a pill in half. You know, one gentleman who told me he was just told he needs 6 to 12 months on one type of medication was told it would cost $1,160 per month. Fortunately, after 7 weeks of different forms and applications trying to find a way, he was able to go to the Veterans Administration and get help there with that medication. But again, it gets back to our priorities and our values as a nation. You know, why haven't we been able to tackle this question? The Republican plan to subsidize insurance companies to provide prescription medication is absolutely the wrong approach. And I agree, it needs to be done through expansion of Medicare so we can solve that problem for our seniors and serve as their advocates.
We're going to break for news here for just a minute, but I want to ask each of you a question about that, follow-up on that. The Republicans have their plan this year to deal with the prescription drug issue. Democrats have theirs. The net result appears that nothing's going to happen again this year.
Right.
If people were in the Senate right now, recognizing that Republicans are in the majority, would you support the Republican plan so that at least something would get passed this year to provide some relief for some Americans? Or would you hang in there for that Democrat plan, which is not going to become law this year?
Well, Gary, if I could comment on that. The interesting thing in the Republican plan is the insurance companies don't want any part of it. So they talk about doing this privately and working with insurance companies. I mean, they recognize the risk there. The experts in the industry recognize how difficult it is to be able to actually perform there. And I think that's the message that has to come through. This is an issue of leadership. and it's an issue of bringing people together to find the right solution and move forward.
So you'd hold Gary, firm. And,
well, wait,
and,
Gary. My dad is 82.
Jerry Janicich.
My dad is 82 years old. My mother is 78. John Kennedy in 1960 talked about this. In 40 years, this country has gone nowhere on the issue, and I would try to take as much as somebody was offering at this point and get on with it. Part of what's going on in our country today and why people are cynical is nothing appears to ever get accomplished. And it's both parties' fault, all right? But I think you got to get what you can get and move on. They don't deserve to be going through that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, Jerry, this is Mike Cerisi. I've heard a lot of that during the course of my career. You couldn't get the Delcon shield off the market. You couldn't get the Copper 7 off the market. You couldn't take on tobacco. They're too powerful. Take what you can get and get out. A lot of people did that. That's not leadership. Leadership is taking
Michael,
on the... Let me finish, Jerry.
This isn't about going to court.
Let me finish,
this
Jerry.
This is about trying
May
to take care of...
May I finish?
Go ahead.
All right, thank you. This is about leadership, about getting things done. People want
exactly.
a doer. Now, let me finish.
In the minority.
Let me finish, please. People want a doer to get things done. Gary, you want to know what I would do? What I would do is set up a more comprehensive bill, just like the Republicans say they're in favor of increasing the minimum wage, and yet they attack $260 billion worth of tax cuts for the very wealthy to the bill. I would say, all right, we're going to attack prescription drugs. We're going to extend Medicare to prescription drugs. We're going to have an importation bill, which I've talked about for months and months. We're going to say that there's no more direct advertising, and we're going to say to these drug companies, you can no longer pay generic manufacturers to keep generics off the market so your branded drugs can continue to sell with a monopoly using the patent system in an inappropriate way. That's where I'd start. And then we'd start from that angle and move a lot more toward the Democratic plan than the Republican plan. And in the end result, yes, you do have compromise, but you do it with leadership. And that's what people want in the Senate. They want somebody who is going to lead, not somebody who's going to say we can take what we can get.
That's Jerry Janicich.
Michael, you ended up compromising. All I did was set it quicker. All right? You can't, that's the U.S. Senate. That's not about winning on every issue all the time. That's about eventually here, part of what's happened in our state and in our country is because we've put ourselves in corners all the time, we don't go anywhere. And in those buildings, sometimes you have to compromise. And when you're in the minority, it's a lot tougher. When you're in the majority, you have a tendency, and I've been fortunate enough because in the state Senate and the Minnesota House, I've been in the majority.
Jerry, you come from the Iron Range. You're a Democrat from the Iron Range. I mean, my goodness, a Republican up there gets lost.
Okay. And they should, but I've been in the majority in those those buildings. I've been in the majority. All right? And we, my 82-year-old dad and my 78-year-old mother doesn't care anymore about what party. They want to see their government work for them. And they don't really think that getting in a bus and riding up to Canada is a good idea. They would like to just go to the drugstore on Main Street. We've let this issue get away, and we shouldn't. I mean, we shouldn't as a nation. We shouldn't do that. My dad is a veteran, and you had talked about the veteran health care and the veteran. Okay, I'll come back. Go ahead, Gary.
Mark Dayton, any comment at all before we break here?
They're both right.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this
Mark
is a special...
Mark just compromised. That's what politics is.
This is a special two-hour edition of Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Today we're talking with the major candidates for the DFL nomination for the U.S. Senate. The election is just a month away. Now, if you have a question for the candidates, here's your opportunity. We're going to open the phone lines for a few minutes. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828 if you have a question for the candidates. They are, once again, business executive Rebecca Yanish, State Senator Jerry Janicich, former State Auditor Mark Dayton, trial attorney Michael Cerisi. Now, if you'd like to watch this discussion, a reminder that we are webcasting this program today. Just log on to minnesotapublicradio.org. And you can see the candidates in action. It's kind of like those old pictures, though, from space. Remember where they'd kind of be there frozen in time for a few seconds, and then you jump to the next picture. But it's kind of cool. And
frozen distance.
In time. Yeah. Yeah.
We all probably
we all do. We also have a forum that we're conducting. If you'd like to share some comments on the discussion as we go along, again, that's MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Now, while we're waiting for callers to get lined up, let me put one other issue out here on the table that we can kick around briefly before we get to the callers. I know all of you are generally opposed to Senator Graham's proposals for fairly broad federal tax cuts, but do you support any tax cuts whatsoever?
Well, I do.
I'll start on that one since Mark, I waited, ceded my time on the last round, if I may.
Mark Dayton. Mark,
thank you. I proposed 2 weeks ago that instead of the Graham's proposal to eliminate estate taxes, which would benefit only the wealthiest 2% of Americans, not upon their death, but on the passage of their taxable estates onto their heirs, undeserving heirs like myself, in some cases, that $106 billion over 10 years could be far better spent for increasing our funding for public education, special education being the federal responsibility, student aid for higher education, child care, child nutrition, Head Start, you run the list. And I think this kind of, you know, here we have this window of opportunity to do some things in America, and the Republicans are falling all over themselves to give away tax breaks to the very wealthiest, the least in need in this society, the most advantage from all of this prosperity and the run-up of the market and the like. And, I mean, there couldn't be a clearer choice for Minnesotans between Rod Graham's and whichever one of us comes out of this primary to say, hey, you know, what are our priorities? And as my friend Paul Wellstone says when he concludes a lot of his speeches, if not now, when? And if we're not going to take this, if we're going to take this opportunity to give more tax breaks to the wealthiest 2%, the average payment is $5 million the estate that's taxed. That's the average level. If we're going to, you know, say, well, you know, that's the level where we're going to target our assistance, and we're going to leave out the elderly, we're going to leave out the kids. I mean, I just think this country loses any moral authority whatsoever.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, let me just briefly touch on the inheritance tax, because the Republicans, you know, they applied the term death tax. I mean, it's all emotion that they're dealing with. What we can do, if we look at that tax, there's only about 1,500 individuals or businesses, farms or businesses, small ones that are affected every year. That's an average of 30 per state. We can increase the exemption and accelerate the availability of that exemption and take care of that right now. But let's put that aside, because Mark is absolutely right. The inheritance tax falls generally on the very wealthy. I have talked about the Family Security Bill, and this is a comprehensive bill that would take 20% of the non-Social Security tax and direct it in form of tax credits to the people who need it, the people who have been left behind. The Republicans over the last 20 years have given massive tax cuts to the wealthy. We as Democrats have started to help the poor move up the economic ladder. The people in the middle have been left behind. So I'm targeting this towards people who make from zero up to $90,000 to $100,000. And it can be used for, you can put it away tax-free, it can grow tax-free, and it can be used for education, to purchase your first home, for retirement, or for catastrophic illnesses. That's a true tax cut for the people who need it. And this can be dovetailed with the earned income tax credit, which can be increased. That's what we need. This is the missing middle. The people have been left behind. They're being buffeted by college education costs. They're being buffeted by having to take care of their parents who are living much longer. They're trying to get their kids through school. They're trying to get a new home. We have no affordable housing in this nation. That's what it can be used for, and that's what we should do. And that's different than the rest of my respected Democrats here at this
actually,
table.
Michael, I'm talking about a
tax cut. Let me finish. And certainly dramatically and drastically different than what the Republican plan is, which is to give, as Mark said, the overwhelming majority of a tax cut to the wealthiest of Americans.
Rebecca Yanish?
Well, the former small business owner myself and someone who's a fifth-generation family farmer, this rhetoric right now on the death tax is certainly something I understand in terms of the burden that can be on small business. But Mike correctly points out that it's a small number of businesses that this pertains to and that are impacted right now. And there is a way to provide immediate relief to this. I think it's important in this debate to point out again, here's the classic example of of what people dislike about Washington, because the rhetoric in this debate has gotten so horrible in terms of extreme on either end of it. The Democratic proposal for the estate tax provided immediate relief to those small businesses and family farms, rather than staging in changes in the tax cut over time. And when people who were backing the Republican plan were actually presented and said, what would you think of this alternative? They said, that's great, let's do it. And they said, well, that's the Democratic plan. But people weren't recognizing it. So again, it's this polarization and using a rhetoric to divide our nation rather than bringing it together. And I think the bringing together we need to do, and the voice that I'd bring in that discussion is saying, yes, I understand the needs of small business. I understand the needs of family farms. And there is a way to approach this so that they can provide the benefit without this windfall to the wealthiest 2% of our nation. And that's really what we need to be focusing in on.
Jerry Janusich.
Gary, we have a chance, I think an opportunity here, to do almost anything we really want as a country and have the political will to do. And I've talked about doing something in the tax area. We can invest and make Social Security whole. We can put prescription drugs in under Medicare. Very easily we can do those things. We can invest in public education. We can invest in affordable housing. And we can actually even take a shot at doing the debt, paying off some of the debt. And we can close the income gap that's been growing for the last 20 years. The difference between the haves and the have-nots 20 years ago was 40 to 1. Today it's 400 to 1. And that I think you do with a targeted tax break. And it is from zero. I'd like to think it's from zero to 150,000 probably, where we're having a lot of problems. The average income in the metropolitan area is $65,000. The average home is 150. It doesn't work. The numbers don't work for our people. Most of our Democrats are working one job, maybe two, or there's two people in a family doing it. So the income has been driven up, but so has daycare costs, infant care costs, and housing costs.
Okay, a couple of quick comments, and then I'm going to get the listener calls.
Circle back.
Mark Dayton.
Thank you, Gary. I've been proposing for weeks now targeted tax credits, one for child care. Right now, federal is 20%, and it should be 50%, and there should be a great increase in the income ceiling. And the child credit, which Senator Graham's I will give credit for supporting, ought to be doubled from $500 per child to $1,000, targeting those tax breaks to working families.
Mike Cerisi, quick comment.
Well, I agree with that, but let me follow up on what Rebecca said with regard to rhetoric. I think it falls equally on what's called the marriage penalty. When people get married, half people are benefited by it, half of the people are not benefited by it. The Republican plan was to give two-thirds of a new tax credit to the people who benefited by it, by getting married. In other words, they want to give it to the wealthier. That's where the policy differences between Democrats and Republicans come in. That's what needs to be discussed, and that's what the American people need to understand. And it's not just soaking the rich. That's not the question. The question is, who needs a helping hand here to take advantage of opportunities to reach their potential? That's what government should be doing. That's what we're not doing. We need somebody in Washington who's a doer, who can get things done, who has set standards. That's what Minnesotans want in a United States senator.
They're going to like me lots.
They're going to like me a lot better, Gary.
Let's get some listener calls in the mix here. If you folks would put your headphones on so we can hear our callers. And if you're just joining us, we have the four major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate in our studios today to talk about the issues. The primary election just a month from tomorrow, so time is slipping away. Dale, your question, please.
Yes, I'm wondering, I hear over and over again Democratic candidates criticizing any sort of Republican plan, Republican candidates criticizing any sort of Democratic plan. As a young voter, I find this very disheartening, so I would like to challenge the candidates to each list two things Senator Grahams has done that he's done well in Congress.
All right, two items. Let's start with Jerry Janusich. Go ahead, Jerry.
I'm going to need a little time, okay? Give me a little time here. I think his the tax credit for the children thing that he has wearing on his T-shirts is definitely one of them. I think that's the only one he's really talking about.
Rebecca Yanish, two things that Senator Grahams has done that you think are good accomplishments?
Well, first, I agree the tax credit for children is something he has publicized, and I'd like to point out to Dale that that was a lot of bipartisan support for that, and that's one way that Congress worked well in pulling together and agreeing on the importance of supporting our children. The second area I'd point out is, and again, coming back to my hometown, East Grand Forks, Minnesota, was devastated by floods in 1997. Ultimately, Senator Graham did step up to help with federal disaster aid. Unfortunately, it took him an extra 30 days of doing some partisan bickering in Washington before he pulled that bill together. But ultimately, when the time came, when the people that were devastated, losing their homes and businesses, he ultimately did step up and help there.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I would only mention the $500 tax credit because I'm hard-pressed to find another area where he has truly reflected the values of Minnesotans. But I would say with regard to the $500 tax credit, while it is good, you have to weigh that against the fact that the senator has voted, and I'm not talking about him as an individual. This is, he's a nice person when you talk to him, all right? This is policy. He has voted against everything else that will help people who are moving up the economic ladder. So what good is a $500 tax credit if you're paying $500 a month for prescription drugs, if you can't get your kids into college and you can't afford to do that, if you don't have good health care? If you're starving government in all other areas, but then you say there's a $500 tax credit, I think you have to weigh all those things. So this isn't really an issue of personalities. It's an issue of philosophy and of issues that affect working people in this state and this nation. That's what this debate should be about, Dale. And it's really not against about personalities.
Mark Dayton, two things that you think Senator Graham should get credit for?
I would go along with the child tax credit, and I can't think of a second. And I would say, I mean that not disrespectfully, but they'll, for example, in education, the teachers of Minnesota have 15 issues last year where they rated all senators, and Paul Wellstone and Rod Graham's voted differently on all 15. So I'm not trying to be evasive. There just isn't much middle ground here.
Okay, back to the phones. Jim's on the line from Minneapolis with a question for the candidates. Jim?
Gentlemen and lady, one of the perennial issues that everybody's talked about is the National Rifle Association and their position on gun control. In Mark Dayton's last campaign, as I recall, he sought the support of the NRA, and I'm wondering if his position has changed on that. Secondly, I'd like to have the feelings of the other candidates on gun control.
Okay, Mark Dayton?
Well, I fell out the questionnaire. I didn't seek support in 98, in 82. You're right. I did want to go out there because they had misrepresented my position, and I learned I was set up. But I'll leave that aside. I don't subscribe to any organization's point of view. I'm running based on what I believe is in the best interest of this state. And I would say if we can find ways of honoring the Second Amendment and getting guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, I'll support that all the way. And I'm not going to go for the kind of posturing on either side that's not going to be effective. We got 200 to 240 million guns in circulation in this society, and it's a national phenomenon. It's ingrained in our culture, our television, everything else. And so I would say, first and foremost, and I'm proud to have the support of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, let's back up our law enforcement folks. One of the great accomplishments of President Clinton is the COPS program that's put 2,000 additional police and peace officers all over Minnesota. Let's get the people who are carrying guns illegally on our streets out of circulation. Let's back up. Let's take what Vice President Gore is proposing to increase the number of prosecutors so that we can take them off the streets and put them behind bars. Let's deal with some real practical, real result-oriented solutions to these crime problems and take the rhetoric out of this.
Rebecca Yanish?
I think one of the solutions has to really be bringing another voice against the NRA, and I'm very proud of the fact that I was the only candidate who marched first in St. Paul at the Million Mom March and then on Mother's Day in Washington, D.C., in our nation's capital, joining 750,000 families who stood up and said, we must work harder to make our schools and homes safer for our children. And I'll tell you, Gary and Jim, you know, asking the question here, it was very inspirational to be part of that and to hear, again, the commitment of individuals making a difference here. They not only were there for Mother's Day, just last night, the local chapter here at the Million Moms March had a meeting. I was out at that meeting again, talking to people about how we change our gun laws. How do we provide safety locking mechanisms for all firearms so our children can be safer? How can we close the loophole in the gun show loophole that's there right now? And how can we ensure that the regulations we have in the books are really being enforced so that we can provide greater safety to our families?
Michael Cerisi?
Well, Jim, to be specific and direct to your question, I would, and I am in favor of safety locks on guns. I am in favor of background checks at gun shows. I am opposed to the proposal that there be a photo ID, and I think other candidates here are also opposed to that. I am in favor of making sure that our law enforcement agencies have adequate resources, and they have been cut back at the federal level to enforce the laws that we have in the book to make sure that criminals do not have these guns. And finally, I'm in favor of finding some type of funding through private-public partnerships for organizations like the National Institute on Media and the Violence, which is an educational program that goes into schools and into homes and helps people understand the role that the media plays in this and the role that we all have. We all have some individual responsibility on this issue. So those are the types of things that I would do.
Jerry Janicich. Yeah.
And Jim, just to be very brief, I'm pretty much like Mike. I'm from rural Minnesota. We like to think that common sense works here. I've already supported waiting periods in the state legislature. I would support safety locks. I believe education is a big piece. Where we live in northern Minnesota, all our kids have gun safety, and they go through that program. Enforcement, and I think, and I believe I'm for closing the, the loopholes at gun shows.
We have a question that's come in on the forum that's being conducted online. For those of you just joining us, if you want to watch this discussion, log on to our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. You can see the candidates in action and also participate in a forum. One of the forum participants asks if any of the candidates has read the Green Party platform. Let me ask you that. Anybody here? Have you any of you read the Green Party platform?
No. This is Mike Cerisi. I have not.
Yeah. Jerry Janicich, no.
Rebecca, no.
Mark Dayton, no.
Okay, the other half of the question is, what would you do to support sustainable energy instead of using fossil fuels? Rebecca Janicich, I guess you're up first on
sure.
this one.
I'd love to address it. And as someone, again, growing up in the border of North Dakota, where the wind never stops blowing, I think one of our biggest opportunities is actually the wind farms that have been started here in the state of Minnesota. So really being able to look at sustainable energy, I do think that, you know, there's a lot of debate about the use of ethanol as an alternative to gasoline additives. I think that's a win-win for our state in a couple of different ways. It's certainly a value added to our agricultural growers, which I think is very important for Minnesota, noticing how our rural area has been devastated by loss of farm income. So let's find ways that we can provide sustainable energy that provides an advantage to our rural areas in Minnesota. I think the wind farms and ethanol can do that.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I agree on the wind energy. That's part of my platform and has been for quite some time. I visited the wind farms down in the southwestern part of the state. We have enough wind in Minnesota to supply energy for about 25 million people. In the two Dakotas, we have enough wind energy to supply energy for another 50 million people. So that's 75 million people right there. It is sustainable, it's clean, it's efficient, and it helps the rural areas because it gives income to the farmers and provides good-paying jobs in southwestern Minnesota for maintenance workers. That's one thing. Secondly, we should close the loopholes in the Clean Air Act, which enable coal-burning energy sources, what they call stationary sources, that were built before 1990, not to comply with the law. There's an exemption for them, so we have to take a look at that. In other words, we have to direct federal policy toward investment in sustainable and clean energy.
Mark Dayton?
I was Commissioner of Energy and Economic Development for the state in the 80s, and the alternatives that have been proposed for 20 or more years are certainly
good ones to be in favor of, and I agree, wind and others, solar, biomass. The reality, though, is that if you go from the hypothetical to the real, and not just through the opposition of the utilities, which is there, but the practical and the magnitude of our needs are such that we're kidding ourselves if we think we're going to put windmills out in western Minnesota and replace a major power plant. Conservation is the best source of renewable energy. It is the cheapest, most available. We made some strides. We've fallen back. We've fallen back on gas mileage requirements for our fleets. Reducing the emissions from our energy producing facilities, industrial, commercial, is vital. And recycling, which is still something in the society, and not only recycling, but reducing the need. The packaging that comes with American products today is just so much of it unnecessary and costly and energy wasting. Those are the ways we could get much more significant results within the practical limits of the next decade.
Jerry Janicek.
Gary, we haven't had a discussion on energy policy in this country for a long time. And Mark is right. It's not just going to be one thing, and it has to be a group of things. And over the years in the legislature, I've been part of putting together the ethanol piece and part of putting together the wind piece, and conservation has to be part of where we go, and solar has to be part of where we go. And I think that one of the things in Washington we need to do is start putting groups together to come up with a policy that we can live by for the next 20 years.
Not a lot of time left, but let's get at least one more caller on here before we have to wrap up this first hour of our midday program. Barbara, your question, please.
Yes, my question is about affordable housing, that what would each candidate do on the federal level to get more federal funds into affordable housing?
Okay, Michael Cerisi, I think you start on this one.
Well, the first thing I do, you know, the Republicans have supported 100,000 new units of Section 8, but they won't fund it, so we have to fund Section 8. Secondly, I would look to public-private partnerships in building affordable housing. If you go down to the Chaska area, you'll find the Brickyard down there, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You can have partnerships that engage private enterprise through tax credits and also engage local, state, and the federal government in building affordable housing. We have a housing crisis, not just in this state, but in this nation. We've seen in Minneapolis affordable housing go down dramatically. We've seen it in St. Paul. We've seen it around the state. And the problem is that there's not enough incentives for people to get into building affordable housing. So the federal government does, should, and must have a role in this. So that people can have affordable housing. You look at minimum wages, and then you compare that to the price of an apartment here in the Twin Cities, which is $750. That's why we have people who are working, riding the bus at night for shelter.
Rebecca Yanish?
Well, I've been in the trenches working on the affordable housing issue for over 20 years. And, Mike, yes, Section 8 certificates funded by the federal government would be nice, but those certificates are useless if we don't have apartments within the rent ranges of the affordability guidelines. And I think what we need to be doing is, you know, if you look at the prior policies of the federal government where they would fund project-based Section 8 so that you knew the building had the affordable units there, instead of asking the people with the least amount of mobility or resources to say, hey, take this voucher and good luck. And that's really what's happening in our metropolitan area right now. But in addition to that, you know, when we look at the public-private partnerships, the low-income housing tax credit has been a good partnership to bring private dollars to the table. But once again, it comes to an issue of values and priorities, because in that program, each year, the state of Minnesota will generate 3 to 4 times as many proposals as we have funding available for that program. So let's step up and increase the funding there also. But more than anything else, I think what we need to be looking at in this is, you know, who has provided a track record here. And I'm very proud, you know, in my work in the city of Minneapolis, there's 4,000 units of affordable housing there that wouldn't have been there without the hard work that we did over 4 years. And also, you know, continuing the affordability there and creating new units.
Mark Dayton?
Barbara, the people who say we ought to look at vouchers as a solution to contemporary problems should look at the results of vouchers in the housing area. The Reagan administration back in the 80s basically wiped out the really major federal funding, said we'll give people vouchers, the marketplace will take care of it. The marketplace goes, understandably, to those areas that are most profitable, and that's the upper end of the market. And as has been said before, we have an acute crisis in rental and affordable housing in this city, state, and nation. And we have to get the federal government back into providing the financial resources. I agree they should be public-private financing partnerships. They should be administered by local authorities and by community-based nonprofit housing organizations, because the federal government's not a good administrator of these projects. But without those resources, we're going to not even begin to get back to where we need to be.
Jerry Janicich.
Yes, and Barbara, housing has become a problem, not only for our low income, but for almost everybody in our society today. And part of what I've been doing in the Minnesota legislature, I carried the largest housing appropriation bill in our state's history. And that was about public and private partnerships. That was about a challenge grant program that Honeywell in the Phillips neighborhood is using with the Minneapolis community to do some housing. It was about inclusionary housing, which is about mixing housing in neighborhoods. We shouldn't be building housing projects anymore with put fences around them. We should have outgrown that by now, and we should be doing inclusionary mixing neighborhoods up with housing. Those are the kinds of things I believe I bring to the U.S. Senate. I've been doing it.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, Rebecca mentioned 4,000 units in Minneapolis, of which 3,600 were there before you started, Rebecca. And this is not a criticism of you. It's a criticism of the fact that if affordable housing is a priority, ask yourself, who's been the affordable housing champion in Minnesota? We can't name one. It has to be a priority. It has to be a priority, and you have to provide leadership on it. And we can't just point to the federal and the state government and say they're not doing it. People who are involved in it also have to set it as a priority and get it done. And it's not just Minneapolis. It's St. Paul. It's Duluth. It's Worthington. It's across the state. We need to understand that in this nation, somebody has to provide leadership on saying that working and people should have affordable housing.
Rebecca,
that should be a priority.
Yeah.
That should be a priority.
And, Mike, and that is the leadership I provided in Minneapolis. Those 3,600 units you refer to would be private market-rate units at much higher rents if we had not intervened to ensure they continue to be affordable housing. That's very real, and a very real choice.
We can argue about that.
Jerry Janicich.
Yeah, Gary, I think you hit a nerve.
Debate that.
Yeah. I think if you're talking about leadership and you're talking about who has accomplished the most in affordable housing, I mean, the Minnesota Senate has, all right? The Minnesota State Senate has. And politics isn't about I, and I can't take credit for that. But I can take credit for being part of that discussion and guiding that piece of legislation through a body.
Mark Dayton?
The people of Minnesota have been in the leadership positions. ACORN I screened the other night. Community action agencies all over. Project for Pride and Living, nonprofits all over. The people are out there who will take these projects, make them happen on an appropriate scale, where they're needed, how they're needed. The dollars aren't there. The leadership is right there in the state of Minnesota, all over, people who want to, at the grassroots level, make these things work, and the federal government's got to make the wherewithal.
And Mike Cerisi, you're right about that.
Okay,
at the leadership level.
We've got to take a break. Thank you very much. You're listening to a special edition of Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And today we're talking with the major candidates for the DFL nomination for the U.S. Senate. Now we're going to take a break for news headlines, and then we'll continue our conversation with the candidates. A little later, we're going to be taking some more of your questions. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after the news. A reminder that you can watch this discussion on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. There's also a forum underway, so you can participate in that discussion as well.
The Democratic National Convention begins on Monday, and you have the best seat in the hall. I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
And I'm Scott Simon. Join us for complete coverage of the Democratic Convention from Los Angeles, beginning Monday at 7 o'clock from NPR News.
Live coverage of the Democratic National Convention on Minnesota Public Radio begins Monday night at 7 p.m. on the air, and online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Programming on NPR is supported by www.iseek.org, offering customized training, rapid response, and business growth information on the web at www.iseek.org. News headlines coming up.